Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, and where the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, Dr. Theodore Ham, who teaches at St. Joseph College in Brooklyn, and is the Director of Journalism and New Media Studies, and brings a great deal of expertise to a subject that I think is going to be a very important part of the telling of American history, the Bernie Sanders phenomena, somebody that I thought would never have a chance at resonating in America. And in fact, I thought we'd get 2-3% of the vote the first time he ran in 2016 and this last time. And he is now a seminal figure in American history for raising a whole range of issues that were largely being ignored. And a lot of that, according to Theodore Ham, and reads true to me reading the book, is in his book, Bernie's Brooklyn: How Growing Up in the New Deal City Shaped Bernie Sanders' Politics. And what I found fascinating about it is you took Brooklyn, a borough of New York of millions of people, as an example of another view of the heartland of America, where ordinary working people, different ethnic backgrounds, different levels of struggle, went through very hard times, very hard experience, went through the Great Depression. Bernie's older brother was born then, 1935, I believe, and then the war, and Bernie's family struggled. And you talk about that as a cauldron for progressive ideas that were national in terms of the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt, and that's the making of Bernie Sanders. And the critical thing really is this connection to a time when America, once again, is now doing it, but then we had at least a political vehicle of the New Deal that raised the question of fairness, equity, access, and the responsibility of the state to ordinary working people. And yes, now with our current economic crisis and pandemic, we're very much aware of that. But it's a message that has not resonated recently in American politics until Bernie brought it to the national stage.
Yes, he did in his two campaigns, as you mentioned. His first campaign certainly paid homage to FDR. And then his second campaign, he launched from Brooklyn College in March of 2019. And at that event, he made several references to issues like rent control, which he was proposing on a national level, saying that he grew up a mile and a so or so from the college. And that was rent control that allowed his lower middle class family to stay in their apartment and have some stability. His father was a paint salesman with a paint company in Red Hook, Brooklyn. So he never made a lot of money. He worked every day, as Bernie described it, traveling out to Long Island to sell paint. But Bernie and his brother were able to grow up in a city that was providing for working class families and allowing them access to move up the economic ladder. And Brooklyn College and the City University of New York system were one clear example of that. There was no tuition at the City University of New York system, CUNY, until the fiscal crisis of the mid-1970s. So this was the world they knew. It was the world of FDR. It was the world of Eleanor Roosevelt. It was the world of Fiorello LaGuardia, all of whom were committed to programs that were enhancing equality and opportunity in meaningful ways, allowing working class people to find stability in the city and beyond.
And, you know, I think, you know, just to put the emphasis on this, you know, by the way, I grew up in the Bronx at pretty much the same time. And I went to the real City College of New York. But picking up on your idea here of free tuition and so forth, we were raised as working class kids in what now would be considered a privileged atmosphere. Colin Powell, who's written a book about growing up in the Bronx around the same time, and he was in my class at City College, describes what was done for us in his autobiography that is not done for poorer kids now, working kid, class kids. You know, we had even free textbooks. The class before mine was the last time. And you know, get on that subway and get to school and get a world-class education. And we were not considered throwaway people. We were not disrespected, no matter what background we came from in New York City of that time. And Colin Powell has attested to this. Others have attested. And you know, in that sense, they were the good old days. A lot of it had to do with the New Deal, the failure of capitalism during the Great Depression, the promise of ending the war and a new era, the GIs coming home demanding rights, demanding access to education, the GI Bill, and so forth. And in your book, we're introduced to a New York that I remember very well, vibrant, exciting, politically charged, and ordinary people, people with not even, some of them had gone through high school, debating, arguing, checking out different political alternatives. You had all kinds of parties, from the conservative Republican, you had, you know, three communists at one point, and the American Labor Party, and different kind of liberal parties, just on the New York City Council. And reading your book, there's an exciting introduction to how democracy can really come alive. I mean, that really is the world that Bernie grew up in. Now you watch this guy and you wonder, where does he get his energy? Where does he get? Well, that was in the air. It was right there with the stickball games, you know, people arguing about politics and organizing for their rights, whether it was rent control or the right to better working conditions. That in your book is really, and including, by the way, a very exciting session in your book, the whole question of integrating baseball. And Jackie Robinson coming and playing in 47 for the Dodgers, and you know what that meant, and a community alive in a way that sometimes our communities now don't seem alive.
Sure. Well, and then there's elements of the different political parties and influence in the Jackie Robinson story as well, as you know, with Lester Rodney, the Communist Party journalist who was one of the leading advocates for integrating baseball. Through the early 1940s into 1947, when Robinson broke the color line. And Rodney was on good terms with Jackie Robinson. And Jackie Robinson, of course, he has his own political trajectory that's somewhat unique, became a Republican, and then later in his life started moving to the left. But that's another story. But yes, what you're describing is one of the main reasons I wrote the book. Was one of the main things I was excited about was all of these different political parties that were in existence during this period led to all kinds of different alliances, unusual alliances. The issue I mentioned before, rent control, was actually pushed by the American Labor Party, the party that you mentioned that was aligned with the Communist Party. Or allied with the Communist Party. And then it was Governor Tom Dewey, a big business Republican, who actually pushed through statewide rent control in 1950 in conjunction with the American Labor Party against the wishes of the Democratic Party. So you had the Democratic Party at the time was the party of the machines, the Irish-led machines, in the Bronx, Brooklyn, and of course Manhattan, where known as the party machines known as Tammany Hall, was still flourishing. And so LaGuardia was an anti-machine Republican, but who was close to the left-wing American Labor Party and the unions that supported the garment unions that supported that party, and so on. So you have all kinds of different alliances taking shape. Now LaGuardia was close to Roosevelt. But FDR was not a creature of the Democratic Party machine. He had, of those three that I mentioned, he was closest to the Democratic Party machine in the Bronx, but certainly not Tammany. He was not a Tammany ally. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, by the way, just full confession, when I was going to City College, I was only able to go because I got a job in the post office, and I had to go up to, in my neighborhood in the Bronx, I had to go over to the Tammany Hall run Democratic Party headquarters and show them my father voted Democratic so I could get a a letter to take down to the post office. So they had a lot of hold. But you introduce this in your book to a fascinating bunch of characters that, and I don't mean characters in the sense of being superficial. Furlow LaGuardia, the great figure, the mayor of New York, the Little Flower is his Italian name translated, but I think he was half Jewish and half Italian. I remember I used to listen to him on the radio reading the comics.
Sure.
To us, you know, and there, I mean, this guy was a seminal figure, but he's also, if you go to New York, you see all the freeways and all the buildings and everything. He and Robert Moses and all these people conjured up the modern city of New York.
With New Deal money. Yeah.
But what that I want to get at, because that's the really heart of your book. All of this was done with an idea. You better take care of the ordinary people. You better give them libraries. You better give them a subway system that works. You better give them job security. You better give them rent control. And you go through the whole thing. So whether you were Irish in Tammany Hall or whether you were Jewish and with the AOP or something, the fact of the matter is you better deliver. And Roosevelt, who had been, after all, the governor of the state, he understood that. And the New Deal, well, that was what the New Deal was all about. How do you save capitalism from itself? The country was falling apart with the Great Depression. And Roosevelt, a patrician figure, goes to Washington, and thank God for his wife, Eleanor. And they just have a sense, this thing is not, and the current moment, this book is very relevant to the current moment. Because will this society survive? We just discovered that the last quarter we had 33% drop off of GDP. You know, we're in hard time here, and the question is, with these bailouts and everything, are we going to take care of ordinary people? We're now dicking around about whether to extend this supplementary unemployment insurance. The Republicans wanted to cut that, eliminate it altogether. You know, and the Democrats at least are holding on. But what the New Deal represented is, how do you save capitalism from itself? And what your book really is about is, in the most important city, certainly in the United States and maybe in the world, it was because you had strong unions, you had all these ethnic groups, no matter their differences, they had a sense of solidarity, of demanding their rights, and they got politicians to do their bidding.
Yeah, I mean, there's what I'm trying to capture in the book is also the lived experience of how that played out for Bernie and his generation.
Why we got Bernie. It's the making of Bernie Sanders.
Yep. And his brother, I quote him in the introduction. His brother was, a great source of insights as I was writing the book. Larry, I quote him saying that we grew up, something to the effect of, we grew up thinking, knowing that government could do good things, or that's what government should do, provide for people. And I don't think this generation or my generation or any succeeding generations really had that same experience, because, you know, neither party delivers really for working people at this point. There hasn't really been any great initiatives since the Great Society, which was an extension of the New Deal. So, but in the era that Bernie was growing up, the 30s and 40s, he was growing up in the 40s and 50s. Larry was born in the 30s. This is what they came to expect, that you had to deliver the goods, otherwise you'd get voted out. And as I was saying before. It didn't matter which party you belonged to. So you had a stronghold of Democratic Party votes in the neighborhood that Larry and Bernie grew up, which then was called Flatbush. Now it's known as Midwood. But they voted frequently for LaGuardia, and then they also voted frequently in that neighborhood. LaGuardia was a Republican, and then other candidates that LaGuardia supported who were Republicans. So it was not a given that just because Democrats were registered as such that they would necessarily vote for whichever candidate the party put up. They were discriminating voters who went for the candidate who was most willing to deliver the goods, and they held them accountable that way. By the end of the war, Brooklyn had the largest repository, largest block of votes in the nation. So this was, you know, Brooklyn Democrats were wielded national influence, and this was the heart of the Roosevelt coalition, the liberal Jewish and black coalition that grew up in the 40s into the 50s, carried on after Roosevelt's death. And that was the World Bird.
I don't leave out the Italians, you know.
Well, they were there. Yeah.
Vito Marcantonio is in your book.
He's a pivotal figure. Yes.
Spanish Harlem. And LaGuardia was half Italian, right?
Yeah. He was a one-man melting pot. LaGuardia was actually Episcopalian. Yeah.
And let me say a word in defense of the Irish. I never thought I would be doing this now. But the fact of the matter is they knew their rights. I mean, New York was a collection of people. You know, it's funny because Donald Trump should know this as well as anyone, even though he grew up in a real privileged background. But he knows New York. And the fact of the matter is that's a city of made up of people who came there because they wanted a better life. They weren't going to settle for something that wasn't getting better. If you want to talk about how you make America great again, you got a model in New York City. You had people coming from all over the world, and including from the southern part of the United States, in response to segregation and after the war. And you had people coming from South America and so forth. So you had this incredible melting pot of people who hadn't risked their lives on third-class freighters and everything to get there because they wanted to status quo that was not that great. They wanted to improve it. They wanted to make it better. It was a city of strivers, you know, 8 million, 9 million, 10 million strivers in that area. And if Donald Trump were honest about it, you know, he knew he grew up in privilege just like Franklin Roosevelt did, but he also knew you can't survive, whether it's London or New York or it's Beijing or anything, in a big city if you got too many people that are unhappy. You got to make sure that the trains run on time. You know, you got to make sure that you got employment. And that's why in New York City, you had, in your book, you describe it, the world that Bernie Sanders grew up in, they demanded that government provide excellent colleges, excellent transportation, excellent hospitals. And that's the whole thing that Donald Trump seems to miss about the city that he grew up in that you are describing. And that's the essence of Bernie Sanders.
Well, also public housing, too. I mean, Bernie did not grow up in public housing. But when it was being built during the late 1930s into the 40s, and it then took off after the war, it was a utopian model, modernist utopia of harmonious living with courtyards and meeting rooms and, you know, places for children to play and so on within the space that they were designed. So there was this vision of the future that, you know, the working people could find permanence in the city. And so it pervaded the culture of the era. But when it really started, I mean, coming out of the Depression, after Roosevelt came into office and then a year later, LaGuardia was elected, they just started, got right to work. I mean, LaGuardia and Moses just decided they were going to, rebuild the city and make it, a place that would flourish for working people, put them to work in building the city. They built hundreds of playgrounds, hospitals, health centers, all kinds of different, and schools and on, the list is endless. And, you know, and whenever LaGuardia would run for reelection, he would just tout all of the different accomplishments, and run a laundry list of all the things that he had built over the preceding term. And so that's what propelled him to two times being reelected, against the Democratic machine. The Democratic machine couldn't lay a claim to those accomplishments. The machine candidates were just trying to get a piece of the action from the New Deal spending. They wanted to dole out the patronage and so on. But LaGuardia was a steadfast foe and a foe of corruption too, which is an interesting issue that played out during that period, that working class people very much experience corruption. I mean, nowadays we think of corruption as a politician on the take, right? But in that period, corruption was an everyday thing. It was the mob shaking down store owners for protection money, or bakery owners, and you know, they're affecting the price of goods in circulation in the city. So the working class people and the left really had a strong critique of corruption during that period. That's something to consider. And these were like the everyday realities that the city had very forceful unions on the waterfront, literally on the waterfront in Red Hook. The unions were strong. Also, there was corruption and there as well. So this was the world that Bernie experienced. Strikes were commonplace. The transit workers were always threatening to go out and strike. There was a massive milk strike that crippled milk delivery during the early 1950s. So all these things, even as a young, even as he was born in 41, and so he was only experiencing these things as an adolescent through the early 50s. But you know, that makes its impact, leaves its mark. His family was pro Roosevelt for sure, and pro LaGuardia, and then his mother was a big fan of Eleanor, who really carried the torch for the New Deal after FDR's death in 1945. She was very much a central figure in this life of the political life of the city and the nation through the 1950s.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
You know, the value of your book, and I really would recommend it very strongly for people who are pessimistic about democracy. And I can tell you, I wasn't always happy, you know. By the way, you described Bernie as being lower middle class. Everybody called themselves middle class. but you know, his father was scratching a living, you know, and he lived in a rent-controlled apartment. Something everybody talks about, what is this socialism thing? Well, rent control would be an example of a democratic socialist achievement that, you know, people have a right to lodging, and you can't just keep jacking up the rents and gentrify and kick them out of their neighborhood and community, you know? So he benefited from that, right? And when his father, absolutely, when it wasn't going well, he was able, as you point out, to go to a college, a great college, Brooklyn College, that didn't, you know, when we went to City College of Brooklyn, we thought these places were just as good as Harvard or any other place. They were a bunch of phonies over there, even at Columbia. And you know, we were getting a first-class education. The public schools were first class. I'm not going to say that there were no problems, you know, but even when you think of the national problems, I mean, the biggest one, race, okay? Where did the real challenge came from? It came from New York City, you know. It wasn't an accident that Branch Rickey would bring in Jackie Robinson. They were picketing. My uncle, a welder, would take me to picket Ebbets Field, you know, when I was just a 9-10-year-old kid. You know, that they should, you know, get rid of this color barrier. Why? Because they wanted to have the best team you could have. And they knew that the Negro League, you know, Satchel Paige and all these people, that they had great athletes. So why do you want to keep them out of the sporting thing? And that came from ordinary people, the ability to complain. You know, it's a sort of Roman Republic at its best time before it becomes an empire, that you have people congested, thrown together, and, you know, we're not going to get along here if we don't take care of each other. That was the real message, and it's in your book. You got this incredible, you got, you know, W.B. Du Bois, and you got Woody Guthrie, you got Paul Robeson. I mean, you got, you know, from every race, every ethnic group, and they're all in this, the melting pot in the best sense of it. They're not becoming the same. They're not becoming the same. They're not becoming predictable and boring. They're this incredible collection of separate, individualized people. It's an example of individual freedom, but they're making demands. Why aren't the subways working better? You know, why aren't the streets clean? Where are the jobs? And your book captures a really great moment for American democracy. You know, urban life was coming into its own. People were crowding the cities after the war. They had high expectations, and they were demanding that government work for them. And in New York City, your book captures it so beautifully. They didn't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican. You know, Lindsay was a Republican, right? They go through different mayors. They wanted you to deliver. They had rights. They had rights. And that's when America was great.
Well, that's, I mean, the culture that you mentioned sustains that, right? The politics are synonymous with the culture and vice versa. So then you have Woody Guthrie, you know, he's there living in Coney Island, not far from Midwood or Flatbush, where Bernie lived. And he's married to a Jewish woman and learning whose mother was a famous poet, Yiddish poet. And so Woody Guthrie is immersing himself in Jewish culture and writing a Yiddish, writing Hanukkah songs and so on in that moment. And, you know, Woody Guthrie comes from Oklahoma and his father was a member of the KKK. So he traveled a long way. There, but he's there in Brooklyn. And, same, and he's also there's a segment of that chapter where he's on the waterfront in Brooklyn, a campaign where his buddy from the Merchant Marine is running for Congress, and that's a really lively campaign where he's running against the Democratic machine candidate, and he gets Woody to support him, playing for on the back of a flatbed truck. And then Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Longhi's cousin was Frank Sinatra, who was on the left during this period. And he records a statement in support of Jimmy Longhi. So you got these lively centers of working class politics and culture playing out. And of course, Red Hook was the setting for On the Waterfront. Arthur Miller was living nearby in Brooklyn Heights. And I have a chapter about his work and Death of a Salesman, and how that resonated with the Bernie's father. Quite an impact.
I thought that was a compelling part of your book. That Bernie's father was the Death of a Salesman, and that is really about a disillusionment with a certain notion of free market capitalism.
Yes.
You know, here is his father doing all the right things out there, selling paint and so forth, and it ain't working. It ain't working. And if you don't protect the rights of these people, if you don't give them opportunity, and what they can do in that melting pot, so that's really what it is. It's like it's a stir fry pot, you know. You got all these different flavors and tastes, and it ain't going to hold together if you don't get some symmetry going, if you don't get some fairness. And that's what I think your book is, a great celebration of the American urban experience, but it could be the Paris, it could be London, that you can bring a lot of people together, and this is what much of the world is becoming, urban in this way, but it's only going to work if there's a basic measure of fairness, egalitarian opportunity, and taking care of the people who aren't making it. And what gentrification of these cities and gated communities and privilege, including in New York, is all about is it's excluding people who don't fit in that way. New York, you couldn't exclude anyone, you know?
Sure.
They were there. And you better take care of them or they're going to get you out, you know? And that's the thing that I think has been lost in this country is accountability. The people don't have that demand of accountability, certainly not in economic matters, racial matters and so forth. It's sporadic, Occupy movement or Black Lives Matter. But in the main, the political class doesn't have to respond to really taking care of the people. And what you describe as a New York where everyone on every, and you had what, 20 newspapers. You had a vibrant free press. You make a lot of references to great columnists like Murray Kempton. Even Eleanor Roosevelt was a columnist. And the people could be on the subway and they could turn to the person next to them and say, hey, did you read this? Did you hear about Jimmy Breslin? Did you hear this one? You really have, this book is fabulous as an example of what a democratic, modern, urban society needs to be all about to survive.
Well, thank you. The New York Post, as you mentioned, Murray Kempton, but also Max Lerner. And then later in the 1950s, Eleanor Roosevelt was there too. So this is the heyday of the liberal.
You didn't mention I.F. Stone and Jennings Perry, who were in the Compass and the PM. And
okay.
Also the Bronx. There were a lot of great papers. There's the Brooklyn Eagle. We're doing it now. We're doing right now what people did on a subway platform.
Right.
They challenged each other. They argue with each other. They interrupted each other, you know, but they got to express their needs and their they got to express it in the earshot of people who had real power. There was a constant churning of needs, aspirations, complaints. That's the New Yorker. Cuomo brings it up every once in a while, Governor Cuomo, you know, the New York spirit. But now it's gentrified.
Well,
it's,
I think
it's Wall Street dominated.
Well, that's true. That's the dominant culture. But I think now we're seeing a resurgence, and maybe it's flourishing via social media more than in conventional media outlets. But we see the Democratic Socialists of America. They just had quite successful campaigns in the primaries here in New York, a handful of assembly seats, another state Senate seat, Jabari Brisport. And you know, they're really challenging directly Cuomo's loyalty to billionaires, and they're bringing that. Cuomo pushed through a austerity budget, and now the DSA candidates are really holding him to task for that. And so the next few years are going to be interesting. But all of those candidates are coming out of Bernie's orbit. I mean, so first we had AOC, and then we had a bunch in 2018, and now we're getting more. So Bernie's legacy is continuing to grow here in the place that that shaped that where he began.
It made him.
Well, it made him.
Forget Vermont. You know, that's the sticks. Come on. You know, really. Bernie is a phenomenon. He deserves an enormous amount of credit. You know that because he can get through to people in Vermont, okay? And I don't want to stereotype them. I'm sure they're wonderful. But you couldn't think of two worlds that were so different, you know, than going up there to Burlington.
In the 1960s, Yeah.
You know, but the fact is, Bernie, you know, he was made in Brooklyn, you know.
Absolutely.
He's a made man, a Brooklyn made man, you know. and that's what resonated with the American public. You know, he's authentic, you know,
sure.
He's not on the take. He's not out just for himself. He's telling you what's happening. And your book, I really would recommend this. Let me give it the title again. Bernie's Brooklyn. Well, it's Brooklyn's Bernie we're talking about. It's not Bernie. Bernie didn't make Brooklyn. Brooklyn made Bernie. Okay. But Bernie's Brooklyn, how growing up in the New Deal city shaped Bernie Sanders' politics. Well, that should be a model for America, you know, that actually democracy worked there. And by the way, not just recent history. You're knowledgeable about that. During the American Revolution, it was the most fervent place. Forget Boston, another urban center. But New York City was the center of a lot of dissent, debate, argument, and so forth, much more than more genteel Philadelphia. And so New York has always been that place, you know, of struggle, of controversy, of critical thinking, of accountability. And your book, I really would encourage people to read it, because first of all, very well written. It's a fun book. You meet this great cast. It's like Damon Runyon or something. You meet this great cast of characters, you know, all over the place, you know, they come alive. And then what they're fighting about is not frivolous. It's real. It's how do people survive in a society that is overcrowded, the world's overcrowded. How do we take care of each other and yet preserve our freedom? How do we get accountability? And this book, Bernie's Brooklyn, is a really great exercise in that, whether we're talking about the integration of baseball, we're talking about a guaranteed annual income, any of these issues, they were all at stake in this cauldron that you're describing.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate your feedback on it. I'm glad that it resonates with you, since given your...
I'm here to tell you it's authentic. I grew up in it.
Exactly.
You know, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now at my advanced age. This didn't come from Berkeley, you know. I would have fallen asleep in Berkeley. You know, I had to go to City College first before graduate school almost suffocated me, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I'm not trying to develop some fantasy here. I came alive reading your book because of the memories. You know, when Bernie Bernie was at Brooklyn College. My first wife, Serena Turan, was the editor of the Brooklyn College Kingsman, and she was great, and she would take no guff from anybody, whether it was the school president or the mayor of the city. And sure. And the same thing was true at City College or Queens College. And the whole city had that feeling, edge to it. And that's what Bernie brought to America. That's what Brooklyn brought to America.
I think all that, as well as the New Deal tradition of a fight that government should be promoting equality for working people. And then also the Eleanor Roosevelt and the FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt tradition of the UN, you know, spirit of international cooperation. I mean, that's a whole nother story, but the premise is the equality of nations. And so that's, you know, these are a real, this was the ethos that he brought. He's carried with him since he left in 1959.
Yeah. Well, let me just conclude on that though, this ethos, cause I think it's really important and should be bottled. That's what made the Bernie phenomenon so amazing. I learned about it from my students sitting in Los Angeles at you know, University of Southern California. I thought he was going nowhere. And then I saw all these laptops in front of me had Bernie stickers on them because he was authentic. And so it's really not a question of the accent or what particular city you're in or even being urban. It's a question, do ordinary people matter? And can they make policy? And can they control things? And can they have wisdom? And the right wing view is, yeah, but you got to exclude all these people and you got to be racist and anti-immigrant. That's right wing populism. Progressive populism, and you mentioned people who are advancing it. New York is really a hotbed of it now, right? The very people you're mentioning. And I must say the Bronx scores high too in this, right? What is at the heart of it is that the best and the brightest, meaning the ones who go to the Ivy League schools and come from the richest families and have the best manners, they may deceive the rest of us. That was the whole point of Halberstam's book about Vietnam, The Best and the Brightest. And that ordinary folk who are working for a living and see reality, that's where wisdom comes from. And it's not just a pie in the sky fantasy, but in the heyday of America's most important city, and this was true in Chicago as well, and certainly, you know, right across the country, you know, and you saw it at different times in Atlanta. I was celebrating John Lewis now. That's what he represented. That in these places where you bring people together, the melting pot, you don't make them boring and the same. No. You have a competition of ethnic history, of styles, of races, but in a progressive way, and you hold the political system accountable to deliver to all of you. That's the key. And you capture that. I mean, just let's end with what that city council looked like. You know, you had a mixture racially, politically. The New York City Council, no party could control it, you know? You had lace curtain Irish and Chani Irish. You had Puerto Rican people. You had so many different, you know, it's funny. Let's you know, I want to say something about that word socialism that, you know, they try to wrap around Bernie. Everyone in New York was some kind of socialist, whether they call it, even the Republicans, right?
Sure.
I mean, you know, even the wealthy people knew, you know, that they had to give something back. You know, that was the lesson of the New Deal. You better give it back or they're going to be here with pitchforks and take it away.
Well, right? You mentioned Lindsay, but then there was also Nelson Rockefeller. I mean, they weren't giving up on the basic premise of the New Deal about using social spending and public works to propel the economy. And that didn't change until the mid-70s after the fiscal crisis. So it was a universally held cross party line, whichever party people believed the New Deal approach was the best one, through, at least through the 1970s.
No, yeah, and your book describes really a dance between the Little Flower, Ferrero LaGuardia, and Franklin Roosevelt. You couldn't have two more different people, and a dance basically orchestrated by Eleanor Roosevelt, one of the great human beings that ever lived. You know, but think about it, the patrician Roosevelt from upstate, and then you got the half Italian, half Jewish guy, 5'2", in New York City, and he's not going to take any guff from anybody.
Yeah.
He's going to deliver to the people. And your book is really about that dance between Roosevelt and LaGuardia. So why don't we end with that? Because that was a dance of accountability.
Yeah. Well, there's the anecdotes about LaGuardia flying down to Washington and telling Roosevelt sob stories about the hardships people faced and then returning home with $50 million more in New Deal funding. So it worked out. You know, he brought the money, and then Robert Moses, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad, put that money to use. And so,
yeah, because he told Roosevelt, you got to be accountable. And by the way, Roosevelt appointed LaGuardia to run a large part of the federal program.
The civilian defense.
LaGuardia
yeah.
was critical. Yeah.
So he's a national figure, not only the mayor.
Yeah, so we're going to end this, but let me just say I'm talking to Theodore Ham, and the book is called Bernie's Brooklyn, How Growing Up in the New Deal City Shaped Bernie Sanders' Politics. And I'm offering this book. I'm going to push this book because, first of all, I think it's fun to read. It's exciting. But people want to know, what can we do? They get down. We're depressed now. We got a pandemic. We got an economic crisis. Well, that's what they had in New York when Bernie Sanders was born, and his brother particularly was born in 1935. I was born a year later. You couldn't be born in a worse time. You know, everybody was out of work. There was nothing to eat, everything. So what did they do? They didn't get mean. They didn't blame the Puerto Ricans. They didn't blame black people. They didn't blame each other. In the main, some kind of unity developed. You know, we got to take care of everybody. It was a rare moment. It wasn't only in New York, but in New York, it was on vivid display. You know, we got everybody out of work. Nobody's doing well. All right, we're going to double down and spend more money on these kids and on school and on rent control and on WPA and on jobs and get people through this. And then they rallied, you know, in the threat of the fascism and the war. And then they come out of that with this great enthusiasm. Well, we aren't going back to the old days. We're going to go back to where government is accountable to people and going to take care of people. And that's the promise that was with Bernie Sanders' mother's milk.
Yeah.
Is that not the case?
Absolutely. Yes. That the New Deal would continue and continue to government would continue to do good things for people, for working people.
Yeah.
That was the expectation.
And then thanks to the Republicans and Democrats, they destroyed the promise of the New Deal. And just I have to put in an editorial footnote, one of the great achievements of the New Deal was to have the Glass-Steagall and the control of Wall Street. And then thanks to President Clinton, they destroyed that with a lot of help from the Republican allies he had. But just put Wall Street in charge. And this is a book about when the people of New York were in charge and Wall Street was held at bay because they screwed up so badly in the Depression. Everybody was looking at them with suspicion. And that really is what you need. You have to have the ordinary people hold the fat cats at bay. On that note of my own little editorial, I want to thank you, Theodore Ham, for writing this book. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for getting it up on our home site. Joshua Scheer is the producer of Sheer Intelligence. Natasha Hakimi Zapata does the intros and very instrumental. And I want to thank the JWK Foundation in the name of Gene Stein, for a great writer, for supporting these programs and letting us get them on the air. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. C'est payé, balayé, oublié. Je me fous du passé avec mes souvenirs. J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs. Je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leur trémolo, balayer pour toujours.